Good afternoon to you. It's 12:07. You're tuned to Midday Matters here on 89.1 FM. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. And this is the News Review edition of our program. That means I'm joined in the studio by Bob Kaler. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good to be here.
Today we're talking politics for the first two-thirds of the program, and joining us to round up the year so far really in politics, we have Andy Downs with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Andy, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Tom Hayes, a political science political science professor. Tom, thanks very much for being with us once again as well.
Yeah, we don't do breaking news. My pleasure to be here. Thanks.
And we do want you to join us today. If you have a question or comment for our panelists, do give us a call. The number, 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet. We are at Midday Matters. And of course, as we just heard on the Diane Rehm show, it's convention season down in Tampa and soon to come in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Tom Hay, we'll start with you. Obviously, the race between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney for President of the United States still relatively tight in most polls that are coming out. Can the convention make a difference in terms of undecided voters, or are these really just parties for the base?
Well, I guess you wonder how many undecided voters there are out there. That's one of the big questions this year is how many voters are really persuadable. You do see bumps come out of conventions, and each convention tends to give a little bit of a bump to each candidate, and so they tend to balance each other out a little bit. It is an opportunity in a race like this where Mitt Romney, of course, has gotten through a primary campaign season, but some undecided voters may not have their opinion made up about him or about his running mate. So it's an opportunity for them inform the voters about the issues they're going to run on, and usually these are pretty scripted affairs, which is why surely the Republicans are at least a bit frustrated that their ability to script this convention is being undermined by weather and intemperate statements and so forth.
Well, and certainly half the story so far for that convention has been the fact that there is a tropical storm, perhaps hurricane, approaching that area. I believe we heard it earlier on the show today, but the optics of that situation may not look so good, whichever party was holding that convention, holding this very expensive party in the middle of difficult times.
Yeah, they had the same problem 4 years ago, too, where they had to sort of temper their enthusiasm early on so they don't get a kind of split-screen image of revelry versus, people suffering. So you always have to worry about that a little bit, but it looks like they're not going to be hit hardest in that, specifically in Tampa, but it could go to New Orleans, which creates its own political.
Bob Kaler.
Do either one of you think that having a day trimmed off the convention because of Isaac is going to force the Republicans into a tighter, more focused presentation, or is it would that be a good thing?
I don't know that it has a tremendous effect. I mean, they can pretty much get what they would want out of undecided voters, I think, with a couple of days of the convention. If you've got people who are really just, checking things out, it affects their ability to get all of the people out there that they want to get out there for experience purposes, their rising stars, things like that. So I don't think that losing a day would have a big impact on their ability to get what they want out of the convention.
You know, days are gone since when conventions were watched for, you know, the full day. I mean, we get a couple hours in the evening. If you're willing to watch C-SPAN, you get some other coverage. A couple of the other news organizations, you get a little more. What this will do is force them to be more direct. I think it forces them to focus a little bit more. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because one of the potential problems with conventions, or for that matter, anytime you get a bunch of people talking about anything, is people going off message. And so if you can make sure you have your top performers, your most compelling stories being told, and you stick to those things, you could conceivably not suffer losing the day and maybe even benefit just a little tiny bit.
You know, I'd have to say that one of the things that will compel me to pay attention to the convention is there's a certain degree of suspense. What is the message going to be? Because there have been a lot of messages floated from inside the campaign, not even counting the things that they've had to address reactively. What are your takes on that?
Well, if you were to poll right now, I think the number one issue still is the economy. I mean, the economy has not come back the way certainly President Obama would hope that it would have over the last 4 years. So that's central. But because Romney is running against an incumbent, there has to be a little bit of make sure you vote that guy out, because if you vote me in, things will be better. And the question is, what are those things that will be better? Not just the economy generally, but is it about taxes? Is it about health care? Is it about the cost of doing business, regulation? Goodness knows what it is, but it better all be job-focused, or they will be off message as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, a couple things. I think the Romney campaign has really gone all in on the are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, evidenced by a ticket that has less foreign policy experience on the Republican side than any in 50 years, at least. I mean, that this is, if they say anything about foreign policy, it's going to be very limited, which is unusual given the power that the president has to deal with foreign policy. And putting Paul Ryan on there, those of us in the watching politics business were hopeful would mean that we would have some more granular policy discussions, because that is supposed to be his thing. He's a policy guy. Now, that didn't happen right away as we got off on some more of the soundbite politics of things, but we could have some interesting policy battles going on at the convention, as we were talking earlier. The Ron Paul contingent is there, and the Ron Paul supporters continued to sort of burrow themselves into the conventions after the voting took place, and they will be heard from. Whether they will be a distraction, get them off message or not, that's yet to be seen. But that could push some of these questions about taxes and role of government.
Actually, one of the things that I think might be sort of interesting about Florida, and this becomes real insider baseball, Florida is still considered to be one of the toss-up states. Holding your convention in Florida allows the Republicans, in this case, to spend some time recruiting volunteers who will actually stay and work in Florida. And so this is an opportunity for them to try and move Florida into the lean or solidly Republican category. Losing a day means you lose a day recruiting volunteers, training the volunteers, and getting them mobilized and ready to go.
Well, and you know, I think the contention when Paul Ryan was named as Mitt Romney's vice presidential candidate was that the campaign was giving away Florida because of his views on Medicare, and we haven't really seen those numbers move all that far, all that far toward the Democratic side, have we?
No, the last I have, Florida is 3/10 of a percentage point advantage for Obama. So it's still a very, very close state. But the Democrats undoubtedly are going to, and their allies in the 527 and super PAC world, are going to put a lot of advertising out there about what Paul Ryan's plans for Medicare are. And Certainly the 30-second advertising isn't going to be too enlightening, but if Romney's willing to put Paul Ryan on the ticket, that means that they must be willing to actually discuss this in longer form terms than a few shots back and forth and bring up the idea that, yes, Medicare, in terms of its cost curve going into the future, is unsustainable. So what are we going to do about it? And we've got something on the table. What's the other side's plan?
You're saying we can't have substantive policy discussions in 30 seconds or less. I'm shocked.
Unless you've got that guy that used to do the FedEx ads.
Oh, that's, maybe you can... true. We do want to hear from you during this political talk today. The number 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. We have a caller on the line. Let's go to, looks like we've lost Lynn, unfortunately. Lynn, if you'd like to call us back, that number once again, 260-452-1185. Before we get away from kind of the national scene here, we do have to note, of course, 2008, the state of Indiana went Democrat for Barack Obama, a big win. First time the state's gone blue since Lyndon Baines Johnson. Is that right? Is any chance that the Obama camp sees Indiana in play once again?
Obviously, if you're a candidate for office, you talk about a 50-state strategy, and then the reality is it doesn't become a 50-state strategy. There are approximately 8 states that are toss-up states right now. Indiana is not one of them. There are, for Obama, there are several states that lean to him, and Indiana is not one of them. If you've looked around the state so far, you've seen next to no campaigning by either of the presidential candidates on the major party tickets. You will not see much of them here. They'll all fly into the state. They'll do fundraisers. They will take money, and then they will leave. While they're here, they may do one quick rally wherever the fundraiser is being held, but the reality is the state will go back to its tradition of red.
And it looks like we have a caller on the line here. Let's go to Jim. Jim, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hi, thanks. That call is directed to Andy because of his election board experience, but to the whole panel. Have there been net gains in ease and voter participation because of the new voter ID laws? And are there any measurements to show that the goal of the ID has been achieved? Are there significantly fewer people voting fraudulently, et cetera, or has there been a net negative? People who are qualified feel it's too much of a hassle? And I'll just take my answer off the air.
All right, Jim, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. Andy.
Well, let's start with what voter ID was supposed to address, and that was voter fraud. And unless you have not been reading news or looking at reports from Department of Justice and several other places, there was just never really widespread, rampant voter fraud on election day. Voter fraud was much more likely to take place via absentee ballots. And so the voter ID law, in many respects, was an attempt to address something that wasn't really a problem. As far as it being easier to vote, while the voter ID law does make it more difficult for people to vote because they do have to have a government-issued ID that has a photo on it, their name has to comply with or match relatively closely what's in the voter file. It also has to have an expiration date on it. That, for some people, is a challenge. Although available for free via the BMV, you can get a state ID that meets those requirements. There also has been an expansion in early voting. And so in some respects, it is easier today to vote because election day is now, as I like to tell people, a month long. It's no longer one day. So while we have no analysis here in Indiana, it's quite possible that it will be either a zero-sum gain or a zero gain or loss. And realistically, the early voting will probably mean an increase in voter participation in excess of what the voter ID takes out.
All right. Once again, Jim, thank you very much for your call. Looks like we have another caller on the line here. Let's go to Glenn before we go to our break. And it looks like we've lost Glenn. I'm sorry. If you'd like to call back, of course, the number, it's 260-452-1185. If you'd like to call us toll-free, the number is 1-800-471-9264. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet. We're going to take a quick break. We'll dig into some of our statewide and local races when we get back. Stay with us. This is Midday Matters.
The next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter and pianist Regina Spektor. Her latest album debuted at number 3 on the Billboard chart. At the age of 9, she emigrated with her family from the Soviet Union to New York to escape anti-Semitism. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
American Roots cruises the musical map of Detroit for the sights and sounds of the Motor City. We'll meet the proud people who made the cars and played the bars, including jazz modernist Yusef Lateef and Motown hitmaker Smokey Robinson, plus bluegrass jams, polka bands, and dream cars. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold & Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Take charge of your financial future. More information at Reinbold & Anderson on NIPR's homepage at www.nipr.fm. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne in fall 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum at www.indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
It's 12:24. You're tuned to Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler for this Monday news review. And we're talking politics during this part of the program with Andy Downs and Tom Hay. A bit later in the, they're waving to one another. A little bit later in the program, we'll be talking with Sarah Bird Sharps about the Measure of America project. But right now, we want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment for our panelists, do give us a call. The number, it's 260-452-1185. You can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet. Bob Kaler.
Andy, something that I found fairly persuasive in this debate and discussion over voter ID was a package of an investigation that the Associated Press did about a month ago that said in Indiana there were hundreds of people whose provisional ballots had been voided because they didn't show up with ID. So were they potential electoral scammers who were caught or didn't come back? Were they just didn't have time? Is that vote suppression or is that effective curtailing of voter fraud?
Well, I'm going to say the answer is yes to all of that. We can move on. No, the reality is if you show up to vote and you do not have your ID with you, you can ask to cast a provisional ballot. But then it's your responsibility to show up with that ID later on. So of those provisional ballots that were not counted, some of those people may actually have an ID. It's been issued by a government body. It meets all the requirements. They just didn't have it with them. And they decided, upon reflection, it wasn't worth the time to then go to the election board office and show it. So, yes, there was a barrier put in front of them. If we didn't have the voter ID law, they would have been able to cast their vote. Some of those folks also may not have had an ID. That'll be a much smaller percentage, realistically. Were there any people attempting to be fraudulent in there? There may have been. And did it keep people from voting? Certainly, yes. Some votes didn't get counted because of the voter ID law. However, if they had tried to vote early, during early voting, and they showed up without their ID, then instead of casting a provisional ballot, they could have been told, hey, come back tomorrow with your ID or run out to your car and get it right now, and you can go ahead and vote. So it certainly does create an inconvenience, and that's one of the things the United States Supreme Court said about the Indiana law. It creates an inconvenience, but it does not do so, according to the courts, in a way that puts an undue burden on any particular segment of society. That's what the United States Supreme Court has said, and so that's what we have to accept as the decision for right now.
Looks like we have a caller on the line here. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sam on line one. Sam, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon. It occurs to me, you were talking about earlier that the 30-second ad is not enough to really delve into all these policy issues. It also occurs to me that to be a good citizen and to be a good, especially a good voting citizen, you have to be able to evaluate and understand different positions, and some things are fairly complex. It brings to mind the idea that people that aren't motivated enough to even get a picture ID may not be your most informed and best voters to help make the decisions for the country. I understand when our country first formed that you actually had to be a landowner in order to vote. And I'm not suggesting anything like that, but some minimal barriers to people who really don't pay very much attention to the political process, really don't know what the issues are, and are willing to be loaded up on a bus, taken somewhere, and told what to vote. I'm not sure those are the best citizens to help us make the policies and direct the future of America.
All right. Sam, thanks very much for your call. Let me put that to our panelists here. We have Andy Downs.
As far as whether people are informed enough to vote goes, the question is how informed would people have to be? And fortunately, there are several indicators that people can use and do use for that matter. So, for example, party affiliation does actually mean something to people. If somebody is running as a Republican, it means one thing. If they're running as a Democrat, by and large, means something else. And so they can use that as a trigger. They can also talk to people who are friends of theirs, people who are opinion makers. So even if they invest a minimal amount of time, and that minimal time being watching one version of the news or talking to one person out in the community, they can become a little better informed. And if you've developed a relationship with people, they trust your opinion, they will maybe vote the way you suggest they vote. The danger in giving any sort of a test is who gets to make up the test. So Tom and I can make up a test right now that I can just about guarantee that Sean and Bob will fail. And in fact,
any test, in other words.
Yeah. In fact, we might try to do that. So I actually go out and talk to middle school and high school students, and eventually some student says, you know, if you're not smart enough to figure out how to use the machine, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. And so then I give them a test that was actually a literacy test from the 1960s, and I have yet, even when I let all the students take the test together, I've yet to have any class pass the test, and so I'm able to keep people from voting. So there's a real danger to that. Fortunately, because voting is voluntary, we have a whole lot of people who are not well-informed, who know they're not well-informed, and they choose to stay at home.
And I should say, okay, what ID are we talking about here? For most people, this is a driver's license. There are other things, military IDs, passports, which even fewer people have. But who's not going to have a driver's license? You're generally talking about someone who is elderly, right? Or doesn't have a car for some reason. And I've talked to some elderly nuns who've never had a driver's license in their life, and they are anything but uninformed about politics. And so some of the people who are inconvenienced by this, and yes, you know, you can go, you can get an ID from the BMV to do this, but if you're elderly, you don't have ease of transportation, or you're poor and don't have a driver's license because you don't need one, it's hard. It is hard enough to get people to go out and vote one day, to get them to go out and go get an ID. Nobody looks forward to going to the BMV that I know of, and so that they can go do this. It does create hassle. Now, does that mean that the law hasn't been effective in some of the things that it is looking to deal with? No, we don't really know that yet. As Andy said, that there hasn't been enough time to see that, and turnout hasn't been diminished by it. But that, as Andy said, that could be because of the ease of early voting. So we don't know at this point. And the other thing that you would say with voter fraud is there is a distinction between voter fraud and voter registration fraud. And we have lots of problems with voter registration fraud, where people are signing up individuals to vote who don't exist or things like that. But it doesn't have an impact on the election unless somebody actually goes and impersonates those individuals. And these laws really don't do anything about voter registration fraud. So we'll have to wait and see whether there is a problem with that in this election or not, as there was in the past with ACORN, a group that got specific attention for this. But they were not the only one who were signing people up to vote who were ineligible.
All right. And Sam, thanks very much for your call. And Andy?
Let's also keep in mind that when it comes to that voter file, there are plenty of folks in there who are not attempting to defraud the system, but they've moved out of the state, people have passed away, and it's because of the National Voter Registration Act, it's actually much more difficult to get names off of that list. And so there are folks who show up and they say, well, that's my son, that's my daughter, he or she's moved away, that's my spouse, they passed away. And it can be a challenge to get names off of the list, which actually creates the opportunity for fraud. Although, as I said earlier, there just really is not a very broad record of fraud taking place on election day. Where it was more likely to take place was through absentee ballots.
All right, we've got another caller on the line here. Let's go to Carrie on line two. Carrie, a very good afternoon to you. You're on Midday Matters.
Thank you very much. I want to revert back to a little bit earlier conversation. I listen to a lot of NPR. It's my station of choice, and PBS. And one thing journalists say over and over again, that they've got to be more responsible in asking the right questions to get the right information out. And this is on a national level. And I have noticed that on a local level, a candidate will come in for an interview and say whatever they want, and the journalists never challenge them. And we can go to the Medicare issue, where, for instance, recently Mr. Stutzman said of course, it's going to cost all the Medicare people. $716 billion was taken out of the Medicare fund to pay for Obama, you know, the whole bit. What he doesn't say is the same $760 billion was taken out of Paul Ryan's plan, which he voted for. But the reporter never questions that, and then they say there's no cost if you elect Mitt Romney. There's no cost to the Medicare recipient, but there is. He voted to repeal the law. That means that the donut hole opens back up. That's $2,000 to $5,000 cost to some people. It means the free medical visit that you get every year, that's going to go away. That just came into being. So I want our journalists, our reporters, to be able to challenge when they're doing a one-to-one interview, remarks that are made. Otherwise, the viewers and the listeners are left with, supposedly, they would think, accurate statements, because we expect the journalists to, you know, do this. And or whether, in Bob Kaler's case, it's reported in the paper, we expect the journalists to challenge and come to the interview with accurate information. And yep. Then on the other issue, I wish that Andy Downs' group at IPFW, nobody does state polls anymore. I wish they would do a poll in Northeast Indiana. Do the people want a repeal of the Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act? Right. Two were done on a national level and said 56% don't want a repeal. Rasmussen, which leans Republican, and the PPP, which leans Democrat. But Rasmussen did a poll where they for the state, where they said people don't want the Affordable Health Care Act, but they didn't ask the question, do they want a repeal? And
Carrie, hold on there. We've got a bunch of really big issues I want to get to our panelists. First of all, Bob Kaler, the issue of journalists keeping politicians and candidates honest, or as honest as possible, speaks to a lot of things in the business, but maybe more than anything, that kind of view from nowhere where the journalist is, in many cases, become just a stenographer.
Well, I think one thing, an interesting way that you can pick and choose among politicians who are willing to defend things in depth is take a look at who's been on Midday Matters and who has repeatedly snubbed Midday Matters because they don't want to sit here for 30 to 60 minutes and be subjected to follow-up questions. When you're doing a 30-second interview after a press conference, it's a lot easier to – there are just can't be as many questions to dodge in that span of time.
And actually, let me I hate to say this, because one of the things that that I do occasionally is talk with people who are thinking about running for office. And I talk with them about how to run for office. And one of the things that that candidates are told is answer the question you want to answer, not the question that is asked. In other words, stay on message, stay on message, stay on message. Bob can ask the same question five different ways, 10 different times, and if the candidate is good, Bob will have nothing to report other than possibly saying, why was he good at dodging this question, which he can't really say, because my candidate will then say, well, but I answered the question. You didn't print what I wrote. And so then we get into this sort of an argument. And I think that's an important thing for people to remember. The best opportunity for voters, though, is to go to the town hall meetings, to listen to longer form interviews like you see here. And, of course, to recognize that whether it's limits based on column inches or number of minutes and seconds available on television and radio, there's only so much that can get put into a particular news story. And so listen to Midday Matters, go out and find the candidates when they're talking to groups, and take advantage of that moment to ask them the longer question with the follow-ups, parts A, B, and C.
And I do want to get also into the Affordable Care Act polling issue briefly. Andy, have you seen any statewide polls on approval, disapproval of the ACA?
Actually, we have not. The Mike Down Center has not done any polling on that. And part of the reason we have not is actually cost. To put this into perspective for people, we had a particularly good price for mayoral poll last fall in 2011, and it was still, I believe it was $8,000 just for that one little poll. Hmm. So to do something broader, we've traditionally ended up spending in excess of $10,000 to do those statewide polls. So it's not an inexpensive venture to get into.
All right. Carrie, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. Guys, before we pivot topics here in just a few minutes, I did want to get into there are obviously many other races going on besides the presidential race that I wanted to get into. Of course, probably the marquee race, or one of the marquee races in Indiana, is the race for Richard Lugar's seat between Democrat Joe Donnelly and Republican Richard Murdoch. The latest poll that I've seen was from the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, showed them in a statistical dead heat. Andy Downs, if I'm reading it right, it's been that way pretty much since the race started.
There actually have been three polls that have come out in the last, let's say, month, and all of them show it basically in a tie. If I remember right, all three of them show Murdoch ahead, so that might be an indication that he really is slightly ahead, but they're all within the margin of error. They're all very close. Neither candidate has over 50% of the vote yet, and so there's a long way for us to go in that race still. I was checking around before I came here, and at least one source still is calling Indiana solidly Republican for its Senate seat. I think that's a mistake to say that. I think at best, Republicans would have to say it leans Republican right now. It's a hotly contested race.
Tom Hay, what's your take on why this race is so close? Because Richard Murdoch definitely had an advantage when it came to getting his name out there in that bitter fight between he and Richard Lugar.
He got his name out there, and some people also didn't like it. His favorable, unfavorable ratings, he's got a slightly higher unfavorable than favorable rating with the public. So while he's slightly ahead in the horse race for the votes, Joe Donnelly has about an 8 or 9% higher favorability than unfavorability, although he's less well-known to voters. So it depends on how voters form their opinion of him as things go along. But Murdoch was a polarizing candidate. He appealed to the Republican base, which helped him win that primary election. But with the visibility that it got, it also has given him some problems with independent voters. And while, as Andy said, we're not going to have a tight presidential race in Indiana this time, that you had to have sort of a perfect storm of things come together for that. This could turn out to be a very important Senate race, given what's happened in Missouri. This may be a race that a lot of money comes into now, because it could be a crucial race. So
you're talking, of course, about the race between Representative Aiken and Claire McCaskill?
Right. Yes, where Representative Aiken's statements, which I have no desire to elaborate on, seem to have done him in from the next poll that we saw. We didn't know at first. The overnights didn't necessarily show an impact, and you can kind of get that rally around. So he's doing what you would expect a candidate in this situation to do, which is try to rally people around him, saying that he's being pushed out. Call it the Marion Barry strategy, if you want, which sometimes works. He was down by about 9 in the last poll that I saw, so it seems to have some impact. So the race between Murdoch and Donnelly could end up being a pretty important one in the national scene.
Looks like we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Glenn on line one. Glenn, we're just about out of time for this segment. Please do be brief.
Okay, yes. I have several questions concerning the effectiveness of the president's message and the race and his stimulus package. I'm wanting to know about how much money was involved in the stimulus package, how many states participated in the stimulus package. Do you think it's been effective, and will it translate into votes for the president and the Democratic Party?
That's one of the central questions pegs of President Obama's presidency so far. Any evidence whether it's hurting him or helping him?
Well, I think anytime you can look at expenditures that help to keep unemployment from going much lower, those are going to be viewed somewhat favorably, at least not negatively, let's put it that way. So areas that did see visible road construction, bridge construction, et cetera, that's where you'll probably be able to find greater support for it. But the fact that it did not result in, you know, some miraculous recovery will make it possible for Republicans to say, see, it didn't work. It raised the debt and it didn't work. But both sides have information they can use in this particular argument, and it becomes almost a philosophical one. What is the role of government in helping to regulate the economy?
We have to pivot in just a moment here, but I did want to briefly get to the race for governor between Democrat John Gregg, Republican Mike Pence, and Rupert Boneham, the Libertarian candidate. The recent poll that we just mentioned from the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, Pence is far ahead of Democrat John Gregg. 18 points?
He's far ahead. He's actually sitting at 50% right now. Granted, when you throw in the margin of error, that could be below 50%. But anytime somebody this far out sitting at 50%, that campaign's got to feel pretty good about their situation. And it also means that the other side really has to put an emphasis on why you do not want to elect the other side, which can often translate into a very negative tone. So we'll have to see where things go from here. But right now, this does not look like a particularly competitive race heading into November.
Briefly, anything that John Gregg can do to close that gap?
As Andy said, probably go negative pretty aggressively. Pence has still got something like a plus 18 favorability rating, so he hasn't been a polarizing figure like, say, Richard Murdoch has, even though he was pretty active in shaping the conservative agenda within the Republican caucus in the House, he's still very well liked. And of course, Mitch Daniels has high approval ratings, too. So, yeah, you're going to have a tough time closing that gap unless you can raise those unfavorability ratings, and you don't do that by running nice ads.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave the political discussion there for the moment. Tom Hay and Andy Downs will be sticking around for the next portion of our program. In just a few moments, we'll meet Sarah Bird Sharps. She'll talk about the Measure of America project. Do stay with us. This is Midday Matters.
Everyone should be educated.
And this entrepreneur put his money where his mouth is. He created a free online university for poor students around the globe.
I care about the people who don't have the right for education right now, and they should have the right.
But is the school sustainable?
How are we going to make this work while keeping it tuition-free?
The University of the People, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah DeLeo with WBOI News. Acting Purdue University President Tim Stans wants the campus community to honor Neil Armstrong by flying flags at half-mast. Armstrong earned a bachelor's degree from Purdue in aeronautical engineering in 1955 and was awarded an honorary doctorate in engineering from Purdue in 1970. Armstrong died Saturday at the age of 82. He became the first person to walk on the moon July 20, 1969, as commander of Apollo 11. Armstrong donated his papers to Purdue in 2008. He lent his name to Purdue's Neil Armstrong Hall of Engineering. A statue of Armstrong as a young student and a replica of his footprints on the moon are at the entrance. The president of the Elkhart County Community Foundation says a gift of about $125 million from an estate stands to become a watershed event in the history of the Northern Indiana community. WBOI's Will Murphy reports.
Foundation President Pete McCown says the gift from the estate of David Gundlach will rank with the arrival of the earlier settlers of the area and the development of key industries. Gundlach died of a heart attack last October at age 56 after making a fortune in the insurance business. McCown says the foundation will go from distributing about $750,000 in grants each year to 10 times that amount. He says how the money is spent will define the future of Elkhart County. For WBOI News, I'm Will Murphy.
Ball State University students are making a documentary about the automotive history of the northeastern Indiana town of Auburn during the early 20th century. The documentary will show the significance of Auburn and the Auburn Automobile Company as a premier independent specialty manufacturer from 1900 to 1937. Such historic cars as the Duesenberg, the Auburn, and the Cord were made there. Assistant Technology Professor Hans Kellogg says Auburn holds a special place in America's automotive past. He says the goal is to create a feature-length documentary film exploring the heart and soul of three distinct automobiles. Students will visit Auburn to attend the community's garage tour and to film the annual Auburn Auto Festival and the Auburn Cord Duesenberg Museum. American-born Taliban fighter John Walker Lind is headed to court in hopes of convincing a federal judge that the government is trampling on his religious rights by barring him from praying in a group every day while he's in prison. Most of the inmates in the restricted unit at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, are Muslim, like Lind. They're only allowed group prayers once a week. He says their religion requires them to pray together daily. His lawyers say the government is violating a federal law barring it from restricting religious activities without showing a compelling need. The government says daily prayer in groups would pose a security risk. The 31-year-old Lind is expected to be in court Monday for the first day of the trial in Indianapolis. And now back to your host for Midday Matters, Sean Beter.
And minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, you're tuned to Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Glad to be with you on this Monday. And in studio is Bob Kaler from the New Sentinel. We also have Tom Hay and Andy Downs sticking around for this last portion of the program. And joining us by phone now, we have Sarah Bird Sharps. Sarah, can you hear us?
Sure, I can hear you fine.
Thank you very much for being with us today, and we're talking to you just before you're going to be in Fort Wayne. That's coming up on Wednesday, August 29th. You'll be giving a talk called "Our Economy: A Public Presentation and Discussion of a Human Measure of Our Economy." And you're part of a Measure of America. Can you tell us a little bit about what that project is all about?
Sure. Measure of America is a part of the Social Science Research Council, and we're a nonpartisan project that tries to talk about things beyond just GDP and money metrics. And we've come up with a measure that's based on a measure that's being used internationally called the Human Development Index. That's really about trying to move beyond only looking at, you know, GDP and money metrics to understand how people are doing. So in brief, it has three major parts. It's how long we're living. The second thing is how much education we have. And the third, which is also, of course, very important, is how much the typical worker is earning. And we put those together and we get one number from 0 to 10. And that helps us to compare sort of Indiana to neighboring states, congressional districts to other congressional districts. We also do it by race and ethnicity and by gender as well.
That seems like such a broad study. It seems like it'd be difficult to gather that kind of data and get it together in one place, in a way that's well, in a expedient manner.
Well, the good news is that a lot of these data are being collected, and they're in, you know, data sets put out by the Census Bureau, the CDC, by FBI on crime statistics, et cetera. So a lot of it's available, but it's available sometimes in a way that's really inaccessible. So what we try to do is to make these really important data about people's everyday lives more accessible. And, in fact, on our website, we have a cool map tool where you can go and you can look at sort of your congressional district. In some states, we even went down to Census Bureau and compare it to others, and that's at measureofamerica.org.
And can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, why do this this type of measure in the first place? Because, you know, so often that's what we do is we measure economies, we measure personal wealth, we measure businesses by, you know, how much we take in and how much we spend. Why add this additional element?
The additional element is because we, by tending to focus, you know, to over-rely on these economic metrics, we miss really big differences in people's lives, and therefore we get the wrong signals in terms of what policies are important. We don't necessarily focus in the right, you know, geographic area or on the right racial or ethnic group when we want to make a difference, when we want to expand opportunity for people. We need to have a better measure than only money metrics of which groups are falling behind, which groups are surging ahead, and most importantly, why.
Andy Downs.
And whenever you try to gather data like this, it's hard to find uniform measures, and so that constricts what you're able to do. What would you include if you could include just about anything?
Well, I think the important thing to know is that the Human Development Index is just the beginning of a conversation. It includes the basics. You know, are you living long? You know, do you have an education? And are you earning a wage that enables you to have sort of a stable, you know, livelihood? But in addition to that, you know, we look at a whole other range of metrics. And I would say that, you know, coming from an international context, the U.S. is a pretty data-rich country, but we don't use it enough. There are certainly indicators that we wish we could get, and in fact, one of the indicators that we wish desperately that we could get, but that we end up having to calculate ourselves, is life expectancy. And you would wonder, you know, why is the CDC not providing life expectancy? Well, there's not enough demand for those kind of indicators. So we get raw death data from the CDC, and out of that, we're able to calculate. Now, the CDC does calculate life expectancy for the country as a whole, which is about 78 and a half years, but they don't calculate life expectancy by state, by race and ethnicity within states, or by congressional district. And the shocking thing is that, and I can just give you sort of the Mount Everest of this, is that the typical Asian American in New Jersey outlives the typical Native American in South Dakota by 26 years. A quarter of a century.
Oh my.
And that's sort of the biggest gap. But, you know, just within congressional districts, there's a congressional district in Virginia where people are outliving a congressional district in, you know, neighboring West Virginia by a decade. So we have huge gaps in this country on all of these indicators.
We know that when you visit on Wednesday, you'll be chatting a bit about how we stand here. Can you give us any previews of where we stand in Northeast Indiana?
Sure. I think the thing that has struck me the most, I've just been doing some preliminary analysis over the past couple of weeks, is that Indiana is really backsliding and sort of at risk of losing its edge and falling behind really in those precise areas that Indiana really needs to compete in the 21st century. So, for example, what I found was that in terms of the proportion of the population in the state as a whole that has at least a bachelor's degree, it went down through the period of the recession, whereas, you know, a lot of states have certainly backslid in some areas, but mostly not in terms of this critical, you know, credential that people need, you know, to be competitive in the 21st century. So
this is Andy Downs again. How do you encourage communities to make use of this data after they have found it?
I think that, we work with communities across the country. Most recently, we did a report for Marin County in California, which many people see as an incredibly affluent county, but which has pockets where there are tremendous poverty and tremendous challenges. And I think we work with them to target the areas where, for instance, foundations, the private sector, are going to, you know, intensify their efforts. And one of the things we talk about a lot is a better match between industry and the jobs that, you know, that schools are preparing kids for, a better match between the job market and education. But there's a whole range of issues that we work with groups on, depending on, you know, what really comes out as the most pressing challenge for well-being in that place.
We have a question from Tom Hay.
Yes, I've used the HDI in classes before, looking at different countries, but I haven't seen it used internally to compare different parts of a country. What does the use of the HDI tell you about how much inequality there is in the United States between different parts of it? And can you compare that to somewhere else in any way that tells us about the level of inequality we have here and how important that is as a public policy issue?
Sure. And just to tell your listeners, so the Human Development Index was developed about 20 years ago. It's based on Harvard professor and Nobel laureate Amartya Sen's fantastic work on capabilities. And it's pretty well known in just about every country in the world except for the U.S. It's kind of the gold standard for talking about well-being and opportunity, but it had never been applied in the United States before. Our index is modified because, of course, like something like adult literacy, which is important in many developing countries, is not a very demanding indicator for the U.S. So our index is modified to be more relevant to the data available in the U.S. and the U.S. context. And we have found tremendous inequalities from place to place between racial and ethnic groups and even between men and women, really surprising, levels, gaps, and gaps which are bad for those people who are at the bottom, but that it's also really costly, you know, for us as a society and really hurts our competitiveness. So, and whenever we can, we try to make some international comparisons. So on our work that we did, for instance, in Mississippi, we found that the infant mortality rate there, for African Americans, is like the infant mortality rate in Russia and Bosnia. So sometimes when the data are available, we make as many international comparisons as we can so that we can understand a bit, you know, which groups, are doing tremendously well and what it is, you know, that's going on among those groups that other groups can learn from.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. But Sarah Bird-Sharps, thank you so much for joining us on Midday Matters today. Sarah Bird-Sharps is co-director of the Measure of America. She'll be at the Allen County Public Library Wednesday, August 29th at 7 p.m. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio, WBOI Fort Wayne, and WBKE North Manchester. I'm Sean Beter. Have a great day.